The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest today on the program is David Sein, who's Regional Administrator for Region 9 of Medicare and Medicaid. You know, last week we discussed with our guest, Wade Fowl, the pitfalls of the 4% rule, which used to be one of these fixed and firm rules that you had to observe when planning for someone's retirement. We've proven that it no longer works, especially in today's low interest rate environment. Many retirees are outliving their assets thanks to a combination of living longer due to medical advances and diminished assets thanks to two bear markets and now 0% interest rates. And one reason why retirees outlive their assets is not just age, but medical expenses themselves. In the later years of their lives, that goes all the way from prescription drugs to assisted care, these expenses can become real gotcha and catch you by surprise if you are not prepared for it.
You know, it's interesting. As I discussed with my guest, Wade Fowl, last week, the Employee Benefit Research Institute, John, did an estimate in terms of how much do you really spend on medical expenses when you're retired. And they estimated that the average 65-year-old couple will need to save between $241,000, get this, to $326,000 just to cover medical and drug costs. And John, those figures, they weren't talking about long-term care. It was one reason that Fowl recommended that as a couple ages, they increase a portion of their portfolio into stocks, which is just the opposite of conventional wisdom, because you're going to need increasing income to cover those costs that really hit you in the latter years of retirement, because that's when these expenses occur. So when you look at that altogether, I mean, you think about $240,000 to $326,000, that's a lot of money. And it usually comes in the latter years, which is when most people aren't expecting it.
Well, last week, you mentioned studies by the government that suggest that inflation rates are running higher for retirees, largely due to rising medical costs and longevity. So those extra expenses occur over a longer number of years.
You know, it's interesting because people experience different inflation rates, and especially at different ages and depending on where you live in the country. But the government, actually, it's the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, is putting together an inflation calculator that takes factors such as age into account. They call it MyCPI. And what they're doing is they're using the Labor Department's Consumer Expenditure Survey. And what they do is they put an inflation gauge that really reflects consumption patterns of different age groups. And the result is they have 144 different inflation rates, depending on where you live and also your age. And this basket closer approximates probably what people are experiencing, because it's no surprise, as we've been talking here, somebody that's retired, and especially as they get older, are obviously going to experience higher inflation rates. In fact, the government just published a report on that the CPI is higher for somebody retired than it is for somebody younger. You know, if you're in your early 20s, probably you might experience some form of inflation in the form of education cost. But anyway, the point that they're trying to make is they're now starting to realize that, hey, you know, when we take these average CPI numbers, well, that's great if you're looking at an average for the country. But what if you live in a different part of the country where it's more expensive, like here in California, New York, New Jersey, places like that on the East Coast? Or what if you're older versus younger? And so they're finally starting to recognize this. But the main ingredient why retirees face higher expenses is strictly due to medical.
Well, I know you and your guest, David Sein, are going to cover extensively the whole issue of Medicare today on the show. Now, what are the things that individuals should be doing when planning for retirement, especially when we look at spending in the area of healthcare and spending more than people used to do, even more to a point where it becomes a financial draining situation in terms of long-term care. And this whole thing, of course, was an issue we ran into with my own mother, requiring a lot more attention on our part, having to come to live with us, and then all of the medical expenses that were involved and ongoing issues. Talk about one of your clients, too.
This was something that I think we made reference to on a show we did a couple of weeks ago. One of my client's mother had a stroke. She fell, hit her head, and it accelerated the Alzheimer and dementia process. And so now she's in a care facility that requires 24-hour care, John. And all of a sudden, there's an extra $6,000 of additional monthly expenses that weren't accounted for, in addition to other bills and things that have to be paid. So they're drawing down assets. And this is something that, you know, all of a sudden, never had any indication. I mean, she was taking medications, but there was no indication that she was at risk for a stroke, but she had a stroke, and it accelerated what was a situation she was experiencing with dementia.
Well, why don't we talk about practical steps you can take? Because Medicare seems to be almost a grab bag. You may live a long time and not have a lot of issues, or all of a sudden, as you say, some really catastrophic things could be thrust on you. How do you plan for that when you're taking into account healthcare expenses?
Well, you know, the best thing you can do is make sure you include the cost of long-term medical expenses into your budget. You know, the figure that we talked about, the $240,000 or $326,000. Now, if you take a couple age 65, and let's just take that $241,000 figure, you know, John, that turns out to be an extra $10,000 a year that you're going to spend. Now, you might not spend it in the early years, but you may be ending up spending more of it in the latter years. So you either have the assets or you save that amount annually, even with Medicare. The insurance you're going to end up spending, this amount, either in premiums, medical expenses, prescription drugs, it's going to be quite a bit of money, and it averages, you know, roughly about $10,000 a year over your retirement lifetime.
Yeah, because usually when people retire, you know, as far as heavy expenses, the big ones are probably spent on travel or hobbies, and people aren't taking into account the medical expenses that come out of nowhere and hit you in your later years. We did talk about, in my case, my mother, and you recently were dealing with a client's mother there, and you and David Sion are going to cover Medicare today. So what I want to do is leave that issue for that part of the conversation for the interview, since he's with the government and an expert in that whole system there. But what I do want to do is deal with the real issue of long-term care. Those medical expenses you talk about, $241,000 to $326,000, didn't cover long-term care. That's just medical, drugs, and insurance premiums. How do you deal with something such as long-term care? If people look at, say, for example, long-term care insurance, they might be put off just even by the premium on that.
Well, you're not going to hear me shout out a lot of statistics about long-term care in this podcast. Rather, you know, what we found that nearly every one of our clients age 55 plus really gets it already when it comes to planning for long-term care. They just may not yet have a long-term care plan in place. In fact, John, if we were to, for example, open up the queue lines and right now ask the folks listening, have you thought for a minute or more about this long-term care dilemma? We could talk to callers probably for hours. And the thing is, do you know anyone who has ever needed to hire a nurse or caretaker in their home or even move out of their home to get such care? We could talk to callers, John, probably for days. And I think the folks get it. If you're 55 and older, your spouse, and maybe you have four parents between you who put you on this earth, and you're probably thinking of, they may be going through these very same expenses that you may be dealing with. In your case, you took care of your mother. I have clients that have had to take care of a parent actually moving in, or the kids having to chip in to make sure that mom or dad is taken care of. So, you know, this issue is out there. Everybody is aware of it. Many people probably listening to this program have experienced it with their own parents or know friends who have experienced something like this. But, you know, a lot of people just don't have a plan for it.
Okay, well, how do you address long-term care in something that isn't going to break you ahead of time, but will deal with long-term care issues if they come?
Well, there's basically three ways you can address long-term care planning. We're going to cover the three basic ones. Depending on your circumstances, so let's say where your assets are currently invested, there are a number of things that you can do. Let's talk about the obvious ones first. First, the traditional long-term care policy. If you spend a minute or more researching long-term care, you've probably seen a policy like this. You pay an annual premium, and ideally you get these long-term care benefits, and those benefits are going to pay you for the rest of your life or until you need care. So you're going to make the premiums, and the annual premiums have been, as we speak, continued to be increased every few years as the insurance companies are allowed to do this. Not good or bad, we just need to plan for those premium increases being higher than what your premium is today. Most policies start paying your long-term care cost up to a daily limit after you've paid for. Usually they have sort of waiting period day, and this is sort of like a deductible on a car insurance. It's usually a 30, 60, or 90 days that you have to cover the care in yourself. Now, a lot of individuals are good savers, and like many of you out there, good savers, and you should be, you're naturally inclined to self-insure or pay out of pocket for long-term care costs. And this is what we find a lot of people end up doing. Good savers really don't get excited about lifetime premiums that can increase, number one. And they often lament, and I just met with a client last week, where basically, thank goodness, we had a review because they had a long-term care policy, but about a year ago, they moved into a long-term care facility. It's one of those places where you put so much money down, you have a nice apartment, but they also have a long-term care facility, medical facilities at the place. So if you become incapacitated, you can move over to the other side. And I said, you know, you really don't need it, because when you moved into that facility, part of the money that you and your husband are paying for, here's a couple that both had policies and, you know, they were paying close to $14,000 apiece. So a lot of this can really add up. The correct way, however, to self-insure is to have a conversation with your financial advisor where you both agree on, for example, which assets you would liquidate first for long-term care costs. Once that is depleted, what do you liquidate second? Self-insuring, however, allows you to earmark the most conservative assets in your portfolio, which eventually will become the first asset you're going to liquidate, and therefore you want to keep it liquid. Also, if you end up not going into a long-term care facility, well, you've got a legacy that you leave to your loved ones. But your biggest risk with self-insuring is how quickly you can spend through money. The client I was telling you, the cost for the care was $6,000 a month, John. That's $72,000 a year. Finally, the third option, or at least an option that will give you an overview, is using some form of insurance, like an insurance policy. Today, they have insurance policies that have what is called a long-term care option to it. Basically, what it is let's make the math easy. Just say there's a $90,000 insurance policy, and what happens is it's called a living benefit. It's a long-term care rider, and what you can do is turn that death benefit, $90,000, into a monthly benefit if you go into a long-term care facility. So the average time spent in a long-term care facility is a little over about 3 years. So if you had a $90,000 policy, death benefit, the insurance company would give you $30,000 a year. That's one option. Another option is to use something like an annuity. So let's say that you put money in an annuity policy, one on the husband, one on the wife. What you do is you allow the annuity policy to accumulate, or you may withdraw the income if you need it, and it continues to accumulate and it builds up so that later on, let's say that one of you ends up going into a long-term care facility and you never know who that's going to be. It's going to be the husband or it's going to be the wife. Then what would happen is you would annuitize the annuity to enhance the monthly premium, and it would be a larger amount, and then that would pay out on a monthly basis. Part of it would be tax sheltered, and of course, the amount of money spent on long-term care is a tax deduction on your tax return, so you get a double benefit there. The thing I like about this option, John, is number one, it gives you a little bit more flexibility. You're not stuck with rising premium payments that you pay for the rest of your life. And also, you don't want to be in a situation, you know, what if you are 65 or, you know, 60, you have a life expectancy of almost 25, 30 years. Can you imagine what those policy premiums add up to over a 25 or 30 year period between both of you? It's not just one policy on yourself, but on both spouses. So this can add up and become immensely expensive. The idea with the insurance option and the annuity option is if you never end up going into a facility, let's say you pass on because of a heart attack, a stroke, or some other ailment or disease, that way you preserve the assets. You can pass the asset on to a surviving spouse, or if neither of you uses it or uses all of it, you've left the assets there for your heirs, so there's a legacy.
Now, let's put those things into practice. It's time to discuss this week's case study. And of course, in all of our case studies, they are actual life incidents that have happened with people. We've changed their names to protect their privacy. So who are the couple this week?
This week, we're going to talk about John and Kathy Wheeler. John, age 67, a retired engineer. Kathy, age 63. She was a retired nurse. Basically, their annual expenses, John, were total budget was $86,000. We broke that down, as we always do, into basic expenses. Their home was basically free and clear. They had sold the large home, downsized to basically a condominium, and invested the cash difference. They pulled the equity out of their house. They were fortunate enough that they sold their house before the housing market fell here in California, because a lot of the California real estate really got to be expensive during the bubble years of real estate in the last decade. They were fortunate enough to sell that, downsize, get into a condo, but their basic living expenses were $72,000, and then the other portion was mainly travel, about $14,000 a year. So we had a total budget of $86,000 a year. Now, Kathy had just retired. John had retired previously, being older. John's Social Security was $28,000 a year. And what we suggested to Kathy, since she was age 63, that she would take roughly, she was entitled to one half of John's Social Security, would be roughly about $14,000 a year. Since she made less than her husband, we suggested she take half of his right now, and then allow hers to accumulate to age 70, where it'd grow between now and age 70, it would grow at 8% a year. So she was still going to get some Social Security. She'd get up to half of her husband's, but she would allow hers to accumulate, which would grow to age 70. Now, that would do a number of things. Number one, it was going to be a lot more than what would be, let's say, if she took it now. In fact, it'd be less than what her husband's is. The second thing is, if her husband lives, unfortunately in this situation, and we're going to get to this in a minute, both John and Kathy's family, they have longevity on both sides. So let's say Kathy gets to age 70, John is age 73. At that time, Kathy could switch over to her Social Security, and then John would, of course, have his. Her Social Security at an 8% increase per year would be roughly $26,000. So this way, we would be maximizing Social Security, because right around that time, roughly $5,000 a month would be coming in both for John and Kathy in Social Security benefits.
All right, so it looks like here then they had $86,000 of expenses, and Social Security covered, what, about half of that? So what did they do for the other half?
Well, they were fortunate enough. They both had good pension plans. John's rollover 401k currently worth about $900,000. Kathy's was about $370,000. They had $50,000 in cash and roughly about $600,000 in investments. Most of that came when they sold their house, and that was also including some of John's company stock. But it was basically John's company stock and mutual funds. Total was roughly about $1.9 million. And the problem, once again, here is they looked into long-term care insurance. They looked at it. It was going to cost them both. I think John's was going to be $6,000 or $7,000, and it would be about $4,000 for Kathy. So they were going to be spending over $10,000 a year for that. You add that to their already budget of $82,000. All of a sudden now, the budget became $92,000 plus. They were aghast to find out that those premiums could go up. So this is one thing also, by the way, that we've seen with long-term care facility premiums for long-term care. They go up. And that could be something that could really, once again, be one of those gotcha type expenses. So what we did with longevity running on both sides, we needed the investment. So we took about $1.7 million of the assets and we did a split 40% in bonds and 60% in blue chip stocks. The yield turned out to be roughly about 3.5% on the $1.7 million. That was about $60,000 a year, which was more than they needed. They only needed roughly about $44,000 to meet their living expenses. So the $44,000, we got $60,000. So there was more than ample coverage to meet their living expenses. And also there was a surplus, which we recommended that they save because you don't know, and especially with longevity running on both sides. Then what we did is we took $200,000 and what we did is we put $100,000 on an annuity on each one of their lives. And we were just going to allow that. It was a variable annuity. We were going to allow that to accumulate. We had used that for long-term care or, for example, if I don't know, we got into a bear market where, let's say, investments or income changed, they would still have access to the annuities to use for monthly income. But more importantly, we could annuitize that annuity or part of it, like a 5 or 10 year certain, to cover long-term care expenses. If they never went into a long-term care facility, one of them died, their annuity would go to the surviving spouse. If the surviving spouse never used it, the annuity would go into their estate and be a legacy to their kids. So in this case, we were setting aside a certain amount of their assets that would be used to take care of long-term expenses for long-term care and allow that flexibility. And this is what a lot of people need. And one of the complaints that we hear a lot about from people that have long-term care policies is how expensive they are if they have them, the increases they've had to pay as they get older. And then also the other thing is, you know, what if I never use it? I've been paying into this thing for 10, 15 years. It's cost me a fortune. This allows a little bit of flexibility. It would cover long-term care. And also it would be still there and available for, let's say, monthly income or expenses should they occur. And then also, let's not forget, by allowing Kathy's Social Security to accumulate to age 70, number one, it was going to be a lot bigger. So there would be an increase of almost $10,000 a year in 7 more years on her Social Security benefit versus what she was taking on taking half of her husband John's Social Security. So we were maximizing Social Security. At the same time, that's another additional inflation factor that we built into their plan that would take care of these expenses as they both aged.
Well, it sounds like another successful project to get someone on the right track as far as retirement goes. Coming up next, David Sion, Regional Administrator of Region 9 for Medicare and Medicaid as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his lifetime income specialists, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, there are two major programs available to retirees, Medicare and Social Security. But there are a lot of questions that individuals have. How did the programs work? Who qualifies? To answer those questions, we're going to cover the topic of Medicare today. Joining me is David Sion. He's Regional Administrator for Region 9 of the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Based in San Francisco, Region 9 includes California, Arizona, Hawaii, Nevada, and Pacific Territories. David, good to have you back on the program. There are times when people need, I guess, a little help in understanding their Medicare and how it works. Is there a way for them to get that help?
Well, there's lots of ways, but there's a terrific program here in California called the Health Insurance Counseling and Advocacy Program. Like everything in the government, we had to turn it into an acronym, and we call it HICAP. And this program has counselors who specialize in answering questions about Medicare. So if you're eligible for Medicare, you're eligible for free high-cap counseling all around the state.
And this counseling is free of charge?
That's right. This is a state program that gets funded with federal government money specifically to help people with Medicare, to help them understand their Medicare benefits. It's not connected to any insurance company, not connected to any health plan, and they're not selling any products. These are volunteers who have been trained to answer your questions, whether you're in the traditional Medicare program or a Medicare Advantage private health plan. And most of the counselors are themselves Medicare beneficiaries, so they really know the ins and outs of the program and how to help you navigate it.
You know, that's really good, because a lot of times there are different choices that you have. I know for Social Security, when to retire, file and suspend, taking it early, taking it later. So it's good that somebody can help guide you through that. What sort of issues can HICAP help with?
Well, the fundamental one is helping you choose a Medicare Advantage health plan if you want to do that. And we know a lot of people down south are in those plans. One that meets your budget and your needs. And because they live typically in the community, they're county-based, they know the local plans really well. They also can help you choose a prescription drug plan that's available and that would meet your needs. And if you have a problem with a healthcare bill, they can help you straighten that out. If you want to file an appeal, like maybe we didn't pay for something that you had done or your health plan won't give you a service, they can do that. Even if you want to complain about treatment that you receive, they can help you do that.
That's good to know. David, let me ask you this. How does someone with Medicare get in touch with HICAP? Do you do this online? Is there an 800 number? How do you contact HICAP?
There's a statewide toll-free number, and if folks want to jot it down, I'll mention it a couple times now. We'll mention it again later. If you want to speak with one of these trained counselors, either on the telephone or make an appointment to meet them in person, California, it's 800-434-0222. That's 800-434-0222.
Are there any other ways besides HICAP to get this information about Medicare? In other words, are there books? Do you have a website where people can study or learn, or let's say fact questions that people commonly ask that are answered?
Well, a good place to start is our Medicare and You handbook, which we mail to each of our beneficiaries every autumn. That's got lots of easy to understand information about how the program works, how you sign up for the program, what's covered, and other topics. And that same book is available online. If you Google search for Medicare You 2015 handbook, that'll be the first thing that you see.
All right. Now, any other resources that you have other than this handbook? And is this handbook you're talking about? Can you download this? Is it online?
Right. The handbook, again, if you Google it, you can download it, you can read it online. It's what they call a PDF file for that purpose. The other thing that a lot of people like to do is a lot of people like to ask somebody a question. We have a national customer service program for Medicare at 1-800-MEDICARE on the telephone. And those operators that work with us are there 24 hours a day. They're there on the weekends. That's another place that you can go if you want to have a general question or if you have a problem. And then we have our own internet website. It's www.medicare.gov. And there you can find information about Medicare health plans, drug plans, what the different things cost. You can find where are the doctors in your community to take Medicare, what other providers, and you can see a list of all the services that we cover, including our preventive care services. You can compare the quality of nursing homes, hospitals, health plans. Simple five-star ratings are available there. So there's lots of information at Medicare.gov. It's a real wealth for a beneficiary to understand the program.
Yeah, I was surprised to find out that you have actually star ratings for health plans, nursing homes, and hospitals, and home health care agencies, because a lot of times individuals are looking at hospitals or they might look at long-term care facilities. It's nice to know that these things are rated by the government.
Well, you know, that's something that we've done in recent years that is, of all the stories we talk to people in the news media about, it's one that they always come back to, because it's something that people can really understand. And even though people don't always consult that to make a choice, I know I happen to be married to a person that's on the board of our local district hospital. You can believe when it's time to evaluate the CEO of the hospital, they're looking at those ratings. And so I think it has a salutary effect far beyond just making choices. I think it makes the facilities and the health plans better.
David, I want to change the topic and talk about the rights and, I guess, protections that some people have with Medicare. Can you walk us through some of those rights?
Yeah, I think this is an extremely important area that people don't think about until they have a problem. But you've got a program that provides health insurance, But there are a lot of assurances in this program because it is, after all, a government program. And at the very least, at the beginning, everyone has the right to be treated with dignity and respect and to be protected from discrimination in the program. And you have the right to keep your personal, your medical information private. And you have the right to get information in a way that you understand from Medicare, from your healthcare providers, from your doctor. And if decisions are made that aren't pleasing to you, maybe that you can't get a service that you want, maybe we don't want to cover a service that was paid, there again, you can appeal those decisions to Medicare or to a health plan.
What about, for example, things like emergency care?
This is very important because in most private health plans, you know, there's a significant amount of money that you might pay when you go to get emergency care. And the important thing is, if you're in a private health plan, like a Medicare Advantage plan, there you want to look at the materials to understand what they're going to cover for emergency care. You never need permission from anyone to go seek emergency care if you believe that the condition you're experiencing is emergent. If you go to an emergency facility and you get admitted to a hospital, yes, you definitely want to contact your health plan right away to make sure that they can coordinate your care. And if you go and get that emergency care, you'll have a share of the cost that you have to pay. That can be expensive, I know, and then the plan will pay their share. But if they don't pay their share for the care that you believe required emergency treatment, you have the right to appeal that.
Let's take a situation where you disagree with how much you're being charged, or let's say you think you should be covered for something that's not covered. What do you do then?
You have the right to appeal in a case where Medicare or a private Medicare plan won't pay for a service or won't pay what you think should be paid. And you don't need a lawyer. You don't have to have a college degree to do this, and it's free. I mentioned earlier, we have people that can help you do it. And you won't ever be penalized in any way for challenging a decision by Medicare, by your health or drug plan. And many of the people who file these appeals end up with a favorable outcome, a lot like traffic tickets and other kinds of things that happen in people's lives. You don't always have to take it. You can question.
How do you file an appeal? Let's say that you're not happy with something. Maybe you're disputing a charge or maybe what is covered. What do you do? Is there a process you go through?
Yes, there are different processes depending on what the issue is. So for those people that are in the traditional original Medicare program where the government just pays your claim as long as you go to pretty much any provider that participates in Medicare, those Medicare beneficiaries every 3 months get a statement that shows all the services that they've had and what Medicare paid on your behalf. Now, if there's something on there that you disagree with, like we didn't pay for it, all you need to do is circle it, write an explanation on a piece of paper why you disagree with our decision, put those two things in an envelope, and on the back of the Medicare summary notice, you'll see the address where you would send an appeal. Keep a copy for yourself, and you're going to hear back generally in about 60 days about what we've decided about the item that you disputed.
Are there differences in terms of the type of Medicare coverage you have in terms of filing for an appeal or a claim?
What's really different is in the original Medicare program, you always get the service, and then sometimes after, we don't pay for it. So with very rare exceptions, in the original Medicare program, you don't have to ask anybody's permission to go to a specialist or to go have a procedure or something like that. On the other hand, if you join a private health plan like United Healthcare or SCAN, these are private insurance plans where we're paying a premium on your behalf and they're providing you Medicare benefits. Those plans have their own networks of doctors, hospitals, and other providers. And there, you'll have specific instructions in your plan materials about how to file an appeal. And because it's often the case in Medicare Advantage that you're making the appeal before you've had the service, for a service that you think you need, if you think it's very important to your health to have it immediately, you can ask for an expedited appeal to get the answer right away.
So let's talk a moment about Medicare Advantage plans. How do they differ, I guess, in if you have that plan, how is it different from other plans within Medicare?
Well, when we're talking about the Medicare health benefit, there's original Medicare, and that's where you've got your red, white, and blue Medicare card. You pretty much go wherever you want. You get whatever services they give you. We pay for them. Sometimes afterwards, there's a problem with that. That's where the appeal would come in. When you decide to join a Medicare Advantage plan, you can put that red, white, and blue card away and show people the card that you got from your plan that says United Healthcare, Pacific Care, Senior Secure Horizon, and so forth. And those plans are going to limit the providers you can see. They're going to have a network that they work with. So right off the bat, if you go to providers outside of the network, they're not going to want to pay for it. That's a place where you can have a challenge. And then those private health plans will often require an approval before a service is rendered. So you go to your knee doctor, and the knee doctor says, you know what, we got to operate on that knee. Well, in a private health plan like this, the doctor's going to have to tell the insurance company what he plans to do or she plans to do. And the plan may say, you know, I'm looking at this x-ray here, and I think this person needs physical therapy. They don't need surgery. But you might say, oh, no, I want the surgery. That's what you would appeal. That you would appeal to the health plan.
What about appealing, for example, Medicare prescription drug plan? Because a lot of times, I know even in the private sector, your doctor may prescribe a particular drug, and the insurance company says, you know what, it's not on our approval list, we're not going to cover it, we're going to give you a generic. What if you get into a situation like that?
This is becoming ever more complicated, where it's not just generic versus brand, but it's higher tier, lower tier. Let's take that first example that the doctor says you need this particular medicine, and your plan doesn't cover that medicine. They have some other thing. But your doctor believes, no, you really need that. Then you can request what's called an exception to that rule for your particular case, if there's a medical reason for that. And it could even be that it's not that they don't cover the other pill, but they just charge more for that label, let's say, than the generic. If you need that, for medical reason, you can ask for that and be sold that drug at the lower cost.
And how would you file, for example, an exception?
So either you or the health professional that prescribed the drug needs to contact the drug plan and say, we need an exception. And that can be done on the telephone. That's the best way to do that. The back of your prescription drug plan card or your Medicare Advantage plan, if you're one of those plans with drugs, it'll have that information on the back. And generally, a pharmacist at the drugstore will know how to do this and give you the notice that you need to take to your plan. And if they don't give you a notice, ask for it. In other words, if you go there and the pharmacist says, well, you were prescribed this drug, but your plan won't cover it, I want to give you this other drug, they can give you a notice in writing that says that, if that's a problem for you. And then again, in that situation, you can ask for an expedited decision because you need this drug because your health is at risk. And I know this sounds complicated. And I often think when people are listening, my goodness, all these words are flying by. I can't keep track of this. Here's the thing to get out of this. You've got rights. You can appeal things. You can say, no, I don't think I should have to pay for that. And we've got people to help you. 1-800-434-0222. You're going to find friendly Medicare beneficiaries that have been through this stuff and they've been trained, and they can figure out which of these many categories is the one that you need to use for your particular situation.
I want to take another situation because we see this too. David, what about a situation where, let's say, somebody is getting discharged from a hospital and they feel that they should stay longer? Maybe the kids are saying, you know, mom doesn't look right. I don't feel comfortable about this. What rights do they have? Here again, what do they do?
We've all been in these family meetings where you're trying to negotiate this stuff. It's not easy. And it's not just the hospital. It could be the skilled nursing facility saying it's time to go home, or the home health agency saying, we're not going to come anymore. So if a medical provider is going to terminate your services because they think you don't need them anymore, they have to give you a written notice, and that notice is going to tell you your rights of appeal and what you can do. We have an independent reviewer entity out there, quality improvement organizations they're called, and they'll review that case and decide whether your services need to continue or not. You need to do that quickly, and you need to tell them that you want the fast appeal before your services end. And even after the deadline, you may still have appeal rights. Again, those local health insurance counselors can help you with that. But this is a very important area. Don't get kicked out of the hospital if you don't think you should be going home.
David, can you clarify? And the reason I want to ask this, I had a situation where a client's mother had a stroke, was in the hospital. They released her to rehab. What does Medicare cover when it comes to rehab and then also long-term care?
Sure. Medicare does not cover long-term residential stays in nursing homes. But we do cover some extended care after a hospital stay that's necessary to get you back to functioning. You know, years ago when we were young, you'd go to the hospital, stay there for a very long time, and you'd be all better and you'd go home. Now the hospital is where they do the most acute part of the work, do the replacement of the joint or whatever. And then we have specialized facilities to help you get your motion back if it's the case of rehab, or sometimes it may be a period of time in skilled nursing because they're taking care of a wound or something like that. And Medicare covers those services for a fairly extended period of time, but not forever, if they are medically necessary.
Final question, if I may. What happens, I guess, if you have a Medicare Advantage health plan and it tells you you no longer participate in Medicare?
Right. So those plans that you can choose from our handbook, like Kaiser and Secure Horizons and others, have a year-to-year contracts with the government. So those big plans don't go away, but some of the smaller plans go away, and sometimes plans stop serving a particular geography or a particular county or zip code or something like that. So you can find that the plan that you had is going to drop out of the program. But not to panic, if your plan says they're going to pull out, first, you have the option of going back and being on original Medicare, go to any doctor you'd like, or you're going to get a notice before the annual open enrollment period. So during that time, you could choose another plan, or you could look to going with a supplemental product and going back to original Medicare in that way. But what's not going to happen is you're not going to be left out in the cold. You're going to have time to choose another plan if you choose to do that. And even if you don't get it done by December 31st, you have a kind of a grace period. You have a couple months into the next year to choose another plan. And again, this is where those health insurance counselors are really good, because a lot of them are members of these plans and they know the ins and outs. They know which providers are good and they can help you enroll.
Two more questions that come to mind, David, as we close here. What happens, let's say you're retired or close to retirement, you're now getting ready to turn age 65. What is required under Medicare for you to do? Number one, let's say if you're not working, and then let's take a second situation where you turn 65, but you're still working for an employer, for example, IBM or Sony or somebody.
Well, in the first case, let's say it's a few months before you're going to be 65 and you'd like to, you know, take advantage of your Medicare coverage. And remember, the Part A Medicare coverage, if you're eligible, comes to you with no cost. But if you want to have the supplemental medical insurance, Part B, that pays for your doctor services and so forth, you have to sign up for that. You can sign up 3 months before your birthday. You can sign up the month of your birthday. You can sign up 3 months after your birthday for Part B. If you decline Part B and think, I'm never going to go to the doctor, there's a risk to that, because when you go sign up for it down the road, your premiums are going to be higher, and they're going to be higher as long as you have Part B after that. So we advise people to sign up when they're eligible for it. It's a great bargain, because 25% of the cost of Medicare Part B is paid by the beneficiary, and the taxpayers provide the other 75%. So there's not too many deals where you can get a guaranteed $3 for every dollar that you put on the table. So I highly recommend that people do that. Now, for the working person, if you're working for an employer where you have health insurance and you're still going to be working in a capacity where you're eligible for that health insurance, then you don't need to sign up for Medicare Part B. You're automatically going to be covered by Medicare Part A because you've paid in and so forth based on your age, but you should contact the people at Social Security and tell them what you're going to do. They have their own 800 number. They have district offices you can go to. So your employer can't discriminate and not give you health insurance because you're eligible for Medicare. If they give everybody health insurance, that doesn't really change when you're eligible for Medicare. The fact that you're now covered by Medicare Part A will save your employer and their plan some money if you go into the hospital, but they would still be providing whatever, you know, health benefits or prescription drug benefits that they were providing before. And then when you decide to stop working, when you'll no longer be eligible for that coverage, then is the time that you would sign up for Part B, and you would not have to pay a penalty.
David, as we close, can you give out the website and the phone number that is important in that individuals, if they do want to find out information, where they can go and who they can get for help?
Well, first off, I mentioned that there are these counselors out there in the community there, this HICAP program, and I wanted to reiterate the 800 number for that, which is 800-434-0222. That's the Health Insurance Counseling Assistance Program. And here at Medicare, we have a website, www.medicare.gov. It's available to everyone. And if you don't have a computer, if you go to a public library, we've got materials for them. The people in libraries can help you get connected with that. And then we have our own number, 1-800-MEDICARE on the phone. It's 24 hours a day. And we have operators that can help you with really any Medicare question that you might have.
David, as always, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. I appreciate you providing our listeners with all that valuable advice.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess what's most demonstrable here is to understand what's going to provide what. That's the first thing. And in the world of Medicare and Medicaid and insurance and long-term care, that can get a bit bewildering. But the next thing is to have some kind of a backup plan, have a plan B, as well as a regular plan to try to make some accommodation here for various potentialities.
Once again, you know, as David Sion and I were talking about, please make yourself familiar with the resources that you have with Medicare, whether it's filing a complaint, learning how Medicare works, the evaluation of long-term care facilities. There's a lot of information out there. It was funny. I was having a conversation after the interview with him, and he was glad to see that we were covering this topic because a lot of people just, they're simply not aware of the benefits or how the system works. So please familiarize yourself with Medicare, likewise with Social Security. We'll be bringing Social Security back onto the program because I want to cover this thing about people taking their Social Security benefits early. We did a show on that a couple of weeks ago, and it was absolutely amazing to find out the number of individuals that did not really understand the benefits of waiting or file and suspend, as we did here in the case of the Wheelers, where Kathy was going to take part of John's Social Security and allow hers to grow each year. It goes up by 8% a year. Well, you know, you take 8% a year over 7 years, that's a lot. Can you name any investment that consistently guarantees you 8% a year? I can't think of one. So do take advantage of those programs and the website and information that the government puts out for you. Well, as usual, we've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.